So, when we read this book, Many Head Hydra, we noticed that it was talking quite a lot about port cities, about movements of people, whether they're indentured labourers or slaves from West Africa or Irish prisoners of war or whatever, these movements of labour and commodities across the Atlantic. And Bristol featured in it a lot and connected a lot with the west coast of the United States. Obviously, Virginia, very closely related to Bristol, and Jim's going to talk about that in a minute. But what inspired us was is that we thought, well, we don't have to be limited here to just looking at the history of our port, because our port is connected all the way across the world, particularly to the Caribbean and the US and many other places as well. So that's the way we started to try and approach our look at radical history, or try to develop radical history. So really this talk today, which is probably talk number 164, I think we've done in the last 6 years, I'm not joking. That's why we're pale and sickly. But anyway, this talk is kind of, not it's you as well. this talk is kind of perfectly fits into that pattern of the Hydra, because it's really talking about the link between William Penn and Bristol, but also the links, of course, with the colonial empire, and Jim will be talking about that. So it's kind of perfect in that sense, and that's why we're in the US. We're really pleased to be invited here and looked after by a host in many cities, from Detroit, Chicago, to Philly, Baltimore, and then New York. So we're kind of following a transatlantic path ourselves, and we would love radical historians from the US to come over to Britain and teach us some stuff as well. So it's all about learning, and that's why this talk's important, because it does connect the two places, and obviously Philadelphia is central to this story, and I'm going to shut up now and hang on.
Thank you very much. Okay, so we're going to do 260 years of history in less than 260 minutes, that's for sure. So we'll get on with it. Good evening, everybody. Sorry?
Good evening.
Good evening. Come on, you lousy motherfucking! That's better. So I hear that Roger, I hear they live in a republic.
The Republic! This means
something in Britain.
Yes. I hear you live in a republic.
Republic!
Try it. The Republic. It's easy. I hear you live in the Republic!
The Republic!
Freaking
corporate colony.
Oh, you lousy liver! Come on. Here we go then. We want to live in a republic.
It's really an empire.
Yeah, it is an empire. It's a
republic, not democracy.
Okay, we've got a booklet. And we urge you all to buy it. What's the cost of the Republic? The booklet?
$3 for one, or we have other pamphlets. What is two pamphlets for $5?
Two for five. There you go. The ideal, whatever it is, 4th of July present or something. Okay. So my interest in the Penn family, I moved to Bristol. I'm from the northeast of England, but I moved to Bristol in the southwest of England over 20 years ago, and I found out I knew more about the history of the port than the people who lived in the city. And I found it a very exciting place for various reasons around history. And where I lived in East Bristol was the centre of the brass and the copper industry for the Quakers, set up by the Quakers. And they ended up with a monopoly of brass and copper. They destroyed the Dutch monopoly and created the British monopoly, centred in Bristol. The headquarters was just down the road from where I and Roger live, and it's now a roundabout, okay? An intersection. Okay, and lots of research in the Bristol slave trade, and breaking the racism of silence, which was attained in the city of Bristol at the time. Various reasons that we're going to now probably touch on. Imagine Philadelphia before the new Interpretation Center. Yeah, it opened in 2005, that we just had a look at today, the first time. Yeah, that's, well, we take that away, and that's what Bristol was like. It was all about the glorification of colonialism. Whatever. We've got an area in the Cabots. Anybody heard of Cabots? My man. Nah, well, it might have been. There have been Italian navigators And it was their exploration of North America that justified the English claim to North America. Yeah. Yeah. And there's a new shopping centre and it's called Cabot Circus. Okay. It was going to be called the Merchant Quarter, which is about the merchants. Anyway, there's an area there called Quaker's Friars, traditional Quaker area. Okay, and we've got Penn Street, Philadelphia Street, and Hollister Street in Bristol, right in the centre of Bristol. Okay. Dennis Hollister, this guy here at the end here, into whose family Penn married, he married the daughter of Dennis. And but Dennis had the Dominican friar land. You know, the abolition of the monasteries and stuff? Yeah, yeah. He actually had the land that used to belong to the friary on the outskirts of Bristol, on the edge of the castle, if you like. Okay? And these extensive grounds, and they developed, would you believe, a grid system of streets on the outskirts of Bristol. All demolished now because it got bombed during the war, Second World War.
So they were Catholics?
No, they were Quakers. Yeah. Right. Hollister was a Quaker. So this is a Quaker, you know, rational layout of streets, just like you've got in Philadelphia. Okay, so we've got lots of connections with you guys. Okay, this is the place where William Penn got married for the second time to Hannah Callahill, whose father owned all that land. I'll come on to that. Fear not. Yeah, the Penns were at the heart of the English Revolution, a.k.a. the English Civil War. Well, you prefer to call the English Revolution because the king got his head chopped off. That's a revolution in my eyes. Okay. And also British colonial expansionism. Okay, the portrayed in Bristol as brave seafarers, benevolent colonialists. Very important. And they're treated with almost saintly reverence. So, generally speaking, how do the population of Pennsylvania, I'm asking this very seriously, how do they perceive William Penn? What was the things that come into their minds?
It's like he's a good guy.
Good guy, yeah.
Yeah, he's holding his dick on top of City Hall, I mean.
Yeah, he's got the scroll. He's got the scroll sticking out there, yeah.
I think all of those things, plus kind and fair with the Native Americans.
Yeah, with the Native Americans, yeah.
Isn't that immortalized in a famous painting?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, painted by the Native Americans, I believe.
Peaceful kingdom.
Yeah.
Well, they said the lamb. Yeah. He paid the Indians for the land, and that for their land, and that was supposed to be incredibly wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. So, sort of progressive-looking kind of guy in his relations with the native population.
Yeah, I guess compared to the British who are coming to the country.
Sorry?
Compared to the other British who are settling other parts of
The colonies.
Country, yeah. The colonies.
Yeah.
For example,
which colony? Which colony, for example? You say Carolina?
Yeah.
New York? Were they progressive colonies? All right, let's get on to them then soon. All right.
Yeah, well, we didn't have Indian wars like up in New England. I mean, it wasn't as...
Well, in Virginia, they had to die like 40 years straight first.
Right up there on the same pedestal with Ben Franklin.
Yeah.
Obviously,
yeah.
Both loved each other.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah, sure they did. Yeah. And Washington and all these big icons. Yeah. Yeah, okay. These guys did a lot of stuff which we would support. And this guy, you know, what I'm doing with Penn is just showing perhaps the bits that I'm missing.
Yeah.
And we are very interested in the Bristol Radical History Group about why we don't know a lot of stuff about people and why only so much stuff is written down. Okay, but not only in Bristol is he portrayed as a, you know, great guy, but President Reagan honored William Penn and declared them honorary citizens in 84. This very year in Saumur, which is in the Loire Valley in France, they dedicated a square to William Penn. And in Ireland, in the very near future, they're going to set up a tourist attraction about William Penn in Sharon Gary.
But weren't the Irish trying to kill the Penns at one point? Hmm? Weren't the Irish trying to kill the Penns?
We did. Tried to kill him, yeah.
They failed, but they tried.
Yeah, indeed.
Being an honest effort.
Indeed. Okay, so we're going to look at the accumulated wealth of the Penn family over five generations. And not just focus on William Penn, but look at him in context of the generations of the Penns, slavery and Pennsylvania slavery, and then discussion. And look, you want a coffee break in between?
No, we're good.
Okay. Oh, thanks, Pass. Okay, so the accumulated wealth over five generations. So 260 years, starting up. Okay. The links between the generations of the Penns, there's a lot of focus on the individual, William Penn. Yeah. Certainly in England, and it sounds as if it's a very similar thing over here. Okay, because nobody's followed the money. Yeah. Which is the thing, you know, that's how they got various presidents.
Oh, yes.
Oh yeah. Following the money. And that's the way I look at this. Following where the money's going, and who's making it. Okay, so we're going to look at these five generations. The grandfather, Captain William, Giles Penn. The father, Admiral Sir William Penn. Anybody heard of him?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Because he borrowed money from him.
Yeah. Because he couldn't afford to pay him back.
Supposedly, yeah.
Yeah, supposedly. Right. Excellent. 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 Hmm?
Yeah, that was...
Charles II, the Stuart family owed the father of William Penn money, and in turn he gave him Pennsylvania. That's what they're saying. Okay, then we'll look at William Penn himself, his two sons, John and Thomas, and then the son of Thomas, John. Okay? The family is bigger than that, but that's what we're going to look at. So, the grandfather of William Penn, he was born in Mainty, Wiltshire, in England. There's a local church where his great grandfather is buried. Okay, cute little place. Okay, Giles's father, so the grandfather of William Penn, was a law clerk and a chief clerk and counsellor at law at Malmesbury, which is like a market town in Wiltshire, very rural area. Okay. And it was the centre of the wool and wool cloth trade. So what he was doing at that time, so where does wool come from?
Sheep.
The old sheep, right? Okay. To need sheep, to have sheep, you need pasture, right? All around Malmesbury was the king's forest, and it was marshes, okay? So this is the time of the enclosure of the land, right? So the Protestants were enclosing the land, kicking the people off the land, draining it, cutting down the trees, rather like they did in Pennsylvania, cutting down the trees and establishing sheep instead of people. There was more money in sheep than all the people. So his as a lawyer in Malmesbury, significant figure, he'll have been involved in all those transactions. Okay. Wool was so important that in the English Parliament, the Speaker in the English Parliament sits on a sack of wool. That's how important wool was. That was the sole major export of England at that time.
Still?
Hmm?
Did they still sit on that?
No, just woolly-minded people. Okay. So Giles, the grandfather of William Penn, married Jean Gilbert in St. Mary Redcliffe Church. There, Admiral Penn and other children were born. And Jean was later buried in the same church. And that church is a significant... feature of the Bristol landscape. It is more prestigious than the cathedral. It was always backed by the merchants of Bristol, and Bristol exported at least $500,000, and was involved in sending goods to Africa to trade for slaves, and at least $500,000 black Africans were exported to Jamaica and the American colonies on Bristol ships. And a lot of the goods that came down to Africa, trade for slaves, were Quaker products. And a lot of the ships that did that were Quaker-owned.
What would it be going to Africa? What would be in the ship?
What kind of goods?
Yeah.
Woolen goods.
to go to Africa.
Yeah, woolen goods. Oh yeah, oh yeah, big lot of woven goods, glass, brass, and copper.
Who doesn't need it in Africa?
Yeah, iron bars.
Who would they
trade with? Yeah, iron bars at the ports. At the ports where so African chiefs were going inland and capture people, bring them to the fort, and then the ships would lay off offshore, and African traders from the forts would come out, see what goods they had, so they had a variety of goods. They might have just bought a load of iron, they didn't need it. But glassware, glass stuff they might need, copper stuff they might need, linen and woolen goods they might need. So they had a variety of stuff. Quakers made a lot of variety of stuff. Yeah. Yeah. So the trader for that. Yeah,
from reading a book like King Leopold's Ghost, I get the impression a lot of the trade between England and Africa was very empty. Like, England was extracting rubber and ivory from Africa.
Yeah.
But they were mostly giving very little.
Yeah. Yeah, but what wait, it's
were
all really.
Were they supplying the colonies or they were supplying
Yeah, they did both. Yeah, they were going transatlantic as well. But the triangular trade, that's where they were involved.
But just point out, that was probably a later period when they actually took over the interior of Africa.
Yeah.
This point, they're just trading on the coast.
Yeah.
So they're kind of doing it like enslaved.
Yeah. You're talking 17th century.
Much later, yeah.
Yeah. Although there was, as we'll pick up, there was direct trade with Africa as well. Yeah, rubber was a later development. Okay, Giles and his younger brother George were based in Bristol. Okay, so he's the grandfather of William Penn. Okay, the brothers became bankrupt and they took up merchant venturing. Okay, and they traded especially on the Barbary Coast. It's part of the Ottoman Empire. Apart from Morocco, all Tripoli and Algeria were part of the Ottoman Turkish Empire that had stretched all the way around to Greece. All the way around the Mediterranean, significant, really powerful place. The majority of international trade took place at this time in the Mediterranean. Okay, significant. Okay, the people on the Barbary Coast, although it was part of the Ottoman Empire, there was a lot of autonomy in the ports. Yeah, the ports were the significant towns. The hinterland, the inland area, they didn't bother about. What they bothered about were the ports for trade. And there's a lot of autonomy with the people who operated those ports. Okay, and William Penn's grandfather dealt directly with those people. Okay, and he established, to do that, he had to establish royal connections. Okay, so he had to get permission. And what you had to do to get permission to trade in the Barbary Coast was to give a bribe. To give money to the people who gave you the commission and the papers to go and trade in the Barbary Coast. Okay, it wasn't like a civil service, you have to go and see a lord and kowtow, do all it is, get the permission to trade. Okay, so he's given these letters of protection and he obtained hawks and horses for King Charles I, the guy who got his head chopped off. Okay. 37. Just about 4 years before the English Revolution started. He was appointed by Charles I as consul to the Barbary region to execute by himself and deputise people to carry out trade. Okay. Okay. And a lot of the people he was dealing with were Barbary pirates. Okay. People who'd been kicked out of Spain, the Moors who were kicked out of Spain and established themselves in ports along the Barbary coast. Okay. So he's a captain doing this. He's got his fleet of ships, etc., etc. And there was very little distinction at that time. There was no royal navy. There was no national navy. Yeah, they would commission private merchants and merchant venturers like grandfather William Penn to go out and do these trade stuff. And they'd be laden with cannon, etc., etc., to protect themselves. Okay, so it's a warlike maneuver. Because of that, I don't want to spend too much time on this generation, but they had international business contacts were established. Okay, they got significant financial reward. He wasn't doing this, just for the fun of it. He got significant financial reward and he accumulated wealth. The family accumulated a lot of wealth. Okay? At one point he was involved in the attack on Sali and planning the attack on Sali, but obviously somebody paid the commissioners more money and they got to lead the attack and got the plunder from the port of Sali in Morocco. But he was quite up for it. Okay, so the plundering. Yeah, privateer. A privateer. Well, it's different from pirates, is it not?
Not really.
Significantly different from pirates. A privateer. Pirates are democracy on the waves, baby. Yeah? Pirates took over their ships and ran them for themselves. Privateers, state endorsed thugs. Okay. So, George Penn, the brother of Giles, migrated to Massachusetts quite early on, yeah, in 1632, and he became a forest warder. Yeah, so he had control over quite a bit of the natural resources and the clearances of wood in Massachusetts. Giles died probably in North Africa, so the family had established royal connections, trading links with in England, Africa, and North America, and accumulated a lot of mercantile wealth. Okay. This is the family, you know, just two generations before William Penn. But they ain't no innocents abroad, right?
How do you approach bankrupt to having a ship and, you know,
yeah, connections, getting loans, there's no actual details of that. We definitely know he was bankrupt, and we definitely know he became a merchant venturer. Yeah.
So just to once again illustrate the difference between privateer and pirate, they're both doing like espionage type things, like taking over ships. It's just that the pirates mutinied and they had a democracy. A privateer was just like, except they didn't have the democracy.
A state endorsed plunderer. Doing it for gain, which Admiral Sir William Penn did in spades. The father of William Penn. He was married to Margaret Jasper. Okay, he was born in Bristol, in St. Thomas, very close to St. Mary Redford Church, where his grandma was buried. He continued the international trade. He learned the trade as being a sailor, etc., and learning the trade of mercantilism. Okay. In 1643, okay, so the English Revolution was 1640-1649. Okay, so this is 3 years into the English Revolution. So Cromwell, the Cromwellian Parliament, and the Cavaliers. Yeah. Okay. He's just aged 22, and he's appointed as a captain in the Royal Navy. Yeah. This is the Parliamentary Royal Navy.
So he managed to switch sides.
So he's now, I shouldn't say Royal Navy up there, I should say the Navy, the Commonwealth Navy, the Parliamentary Navy. Okay, and his rise is rapid because it's war, and people get promoted very quickly in wartime situations. Yeah, it's opportunity, we're all waiting for. Okay, in the same year, he married Margaret van der Schuur, or also called Jasper, in St. Mary Redcliffe Church in Bristol. Okay. She was the daughter of John Jasper, okay, a wealthy Protestant merchant who lived in County Clare in Ireland. Okay. Her family were from Kempen in Prussia. Okay. And remember the name Plegy, okay? Because that recurs later on. That was her family name. She originally married a Dutchman, de Schuur, and they lived in Kilconry, in Kilrush in County Clare, Ireland. And when her husband died, she inherited those Irish estates. So this is a Protestant Irish estate in Catholic Ireland. She also had a sister called Anne. Her Anne married a guy called Captain William Crispin. Anybody heard of the Crispins? Crispin. There's a little Liberty Bell there. Yeah. Okay. He was a Cromwellian naval captain under the command of Penn's father, Admiral Penn. So this is his brother-in-law. Crispin also worked in the Irish and West Indian campaigns with Admiral Penn. He lived in Barbados when he was en route to be a commissioner in Pennsylvania. His family, when he died, he was going to be given a load of land right round here. Yeah, right round here, right round Philadelphia. And but the money went to his children. And they were part of his children. And those children became very involved in the administration of the state in the early days. Okay, so Margaret Jasper Penn, she fled to England probably in 1641. It was a huge, because the English Revolution started in 1640, yeah, there was huge upheaval in England. So a lot of Catholic landlords took advantage of that to try and take back the estates that they'd lost. And there was a huge uprising in Ireland in 1641, and that's probably when she lost her estates. And when she lost her estates, she and William Penn, sorry, was it on the previous one? She and William Penn, in my glasses, yeah, she and William Penn lobbied Cromwell for compensation for the loss of her estates. And it was a phenomenal amount of money. Remember what it was? 7,000 or something? How do we go back, Rog? No, there we go. Yeah. £7,436, 19 shillings and sixpence. Okay? Yeah. Right down to the last penny. Just like the compensation for slaves after, you know, when they were right down to the last penny. They don't miss a dime, these guys. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, they knew, right, you know, good Protestant accountants. Okay. Okay, in 1644, yeah, in the middle of the English Revolution, he commanded a 26-gun warship, the Fellowship, in the war with Holland, okay, who had previously been allies to the English Protestants, but they became too big for the boots in Cromwell's eyes and declared war on Holland and also Spain at that time. Okay. And Penn, a year later, returned to England with prizes of 4 men of war, 3 East Indiamen, and 7 merchant ships, and that is privateering. Alright, that is going out, plundering, taking it back, and flogging it. All the goods, everything. Okay? William Penn's dad. Okay. National hero in England, William Penn, who's celebrated all over England. Nobody's ever heard of him in England, but at the time he was celebrated as a revolutionary hero. Yeah. He was appointed Vice Admiral by Cromwell, involved in the Battle of Kinsale. This is in where.
Wasn't he already an admiral?
He became an admiral at the end of his career, after he became a Vice Admiral. Yeah. So Kinsale was a significant naval base in Ireland, very significant. Now, then he was appointed a Rear Admiral of the Irish Fleet. Yeah, then there was a major battle in Macroom, in West Cork. It's again in the southwest, near Kinsale. And he was actually awarded later on, in 56, he was awarded Macroom Castle and all the estates around it. Okay, this is part of the English invasion of Ireland.
So these were naval battles? Can
yeah.
you describe these at all?
Yeah, these were naval battles. He was bombarding Catholic strongholds and relieving Protestant strongholds around the coast. Okay, there was also, you know, land forces as well. Good point. Okay, so there's his wife's estate in Kilconry, that's what you got the compensation for. Okay, and he's got this place in Macroom. And the castle's still there, in Macroom. You see, they're quite close together. Okay. Yeah, so in 52, he takes a significant part in the defeat of the Dutch, and he's appointed General at Sea by Cromwell in 1652. Yeah. At some point, he's given the £16,000 to the Stuart King in exile. Yeah, the future Charles.
He's playing both sides.
He's a duplicitous person. Indeed, yeah. 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 So, you know, he's William Penn's dad. He's got a big influence on his son here. Okay. He offered it not only his services and money, but he offered his fleet, the Republican fleet, to the exiled king. But the king said, no, it's not the right time. We're playing it canny, we're playing it carefully, and cometh the hour, cometh the William Penn. Okay. And in the same year he's doing that, yeah, he's sent by Cromwell to take Hispaniola. Yeah. Which is now Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Okay? So they try to take that, and the prized Spanish possession in the Caribbean. The jewel in the Spanish Caribbean Empire. And he's repulsed very quickly. He goes over a massive land army. As a land general, he's a sea general. And Benevolt is the land general. And they're repulsed ignominiously. We've got the rabble. Captain Morgan, the other one, the pirate. Yeah, he's there. Yeah, they picked him up in Barbados and took him there. And he says, sod that, I'm going to become a pirate. I'm going to fight for the British crown anymore. Yeah, he became a pirate after that. Okay. So instead of that, they took the smaller prize of Jamaica, which just had a small Spanish garrison on it. Okay. Because you couldn't go back empty-handed to Cromwell. Yeah, that's the last thing anybody ever did.
Okay. What would Cromwell have done if he knew that he was playing games?
Yeah. What makes you think Cromwell didn't know he was playing games?
Cromwell's son was protector for a year after Cromwell.
Right. Henry.
I mean, he didn't last, but yeah. So Cromwell would have done. Students would come back, I would think. Mm.
It's good, isn't it? It's a good story, isn't it? Yeah. It's full of this stuff. Yeah? Yeah? Cromwell has to use the stuff he's got. He's got to use the resources he's got. Yeah? He had control of the new model army by now. Yeah, the new model army, the revolutionary army in England, land-based, never had control of the navy. Because the navy's dispersed, it's all over the place. It's run by the aristocrats as well. Yeah. Yeah. It's a different ball game, the navy. He wanted Hispaniola, I kid you not. Oh. It was part of the Western design.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah. Cromwell had
a good way to get them killed.
Yeah.
Haiti
Sorry?
Haiti. Haiti was being
returned. Yeah. It was wealthy for centuries, yeah, until the land was depleted through mono agriculture. Okay, so he takes Jamaica, and the Spanish, a small garrison, about 500 troops, Spanish troops, not troops, but men at arms, if you like, on the island, and they're easily overrun, and the Spanish free their slaves, and the slaves go up into the mountains and become the Maroons. Yeah. Yeah, nods around. Yeah, the Maroons were the unconquered, freed slaves of Jamaica, and Britain never ever ever ruled Jamaica. They only ruled the coastline, and in the mountains were the free people of African descent.
Is that where the term Maroon comes from, or is that?
I don't know. I thought of that myself. I should look it up. I didn't Google that. Okay. So Admiral Penn was a slave owner, yeah. I was really impressed actually by the brief glimpse we had of the interpretation centre down in the centre of town here. It's a good step forward. 2005, I don't know if it's an Obama, we were wondering if it's an Obama initiative or something, we don't know. But anyway.
Talking about down by the King Penn's Wall?
Yeah, around there, yeah, the big square, yeah.
Are you talking about Residence House?
That was a serious fight.
Yeah, all the archaeology and stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, where they marked the slaves here.
Yeah, and there's some videos, and it talks about Washington's slave, the escapes, etc. Yeah. Which is good, because that was a big thing, wasn't it, a few years back, right? Washington had slaves and stuff.
Well, people locally fought to make that happen.
Yeah, I bet they did. We had the same experience in Bristol, I assure you not. Exactly the same experience. That's the way, right. Yeah, excellent.
Okay, well, just like Washington was a slave owner, Penn's dad was a slave owner. Okay. When he returned from... Sir William Penn was a Anglican, the state religion of England, Church of England. He had at least a slave called Samson who he exchanged for another slave called Anthony during his travels backwards and forwards to Jamaica. We know he had at least another slave called Jack who worked in his London house near the Tower of London where William Penn grew up. He had a black servant recorded on his Irish estates. So he had at least three slaves, personal slaves, which is quite common then. Yeah. He was involved in the restoration of the English monarchy, King Charles II. Yeah, we've got some quite knowledgeable pods in the room here. Okay. He actually commanded the ship that fetched Charles II back from Holland to England. Yeah. And the king knighted him for that. But before that, the son of Oliver Cromwell, who was also Lord Protector, had also knighted him as well.
Oh, he did?
Hmm.
Richard Cromwell?
Yeah. Yeah, he'd also knighted the father of William Penn. So William Penn didn't mind being knighted again. Okay. And the king said, "My worthy friend, whose heart is ready to aid me in trouble, I rejoice to share with you my joy. Knighthood shall be yours." Which I think sounds rather like a pantomime. Knighthood shall be yours, Dick Whitson says. This is amazing. Okay, and the king also, at the time of knighting him, appoints him governor of Kinsale, that major port he'd bombarded, and awarded him a place called Shangari Castle, again in County Cork in the southwest. So there they are, it's Kinsale. It was one of the most important European harbours at the time, and he becomes governor of that. A significant appointment. Okay? And Shangari, that's where the Penn story is going to be told. One of the first slides I showed about the new visit to the centre. Okay?
So he's getting the rents from, I mean, he's getting all these Irish cousins working for him. In addition to
Well, he's clearing the land, probably having Protestant tenants who are paying him a rent. But he's not there. He's an absentee landlord.
Oh, well, yeah, but that's the custom.
Mm. Is it a good custom or a bad custom? Say, the good William Penn, would he do such a thing? No. Let's find out. No, here we go. Okay. So Admiral Penn died 1670, extremely wealthy. He'd expected an earldom. He expected to become a lord. Yeah, but it never happened. But he lived in that expectation, but he died in 1670, and his tomb is in St. Mary Radcliffe's Church in Bristol. And there's the church today, and there's his tomb, that's the father of William Penn, that's his tomb, and the side altar in this huge, glorious church. It's supposed to be the most beautiful church in England, with merchant money, still with merchant money, called the Carnegie Trust. Yeah, there's a close-up of the, it's very difficult to take a photograph of this because it's so worn down. So William Penn departed this life in September 1710. So there's your granddaddy, folks. Okay, and also he's got his suit of armour displayed prominently, and this church is very proud of its American connection. It's got like a little tourist trail around the church about the American connection. And this is the centrepiece of it. And it's got his armour and the flags of battle. These are reproductions, but until about 8 years ago, the originals were hanging up there. Yeah, from the 1650s. There's a little close-up of it. All the writing here is written by his son, William Penn, your William Penn. It's not really. And there's his crest. Okay. Anybody recognize that crest from anything you see around? Okay. The Penn family always wanted to be associated with the Penns of Buckinghamshire, who were the local lords in that area. Okay. And they tried might and main to try and forge a link and prove their link, because they always wanted to be aristocrats. Okay. Now, it was in the Lord's interest also to be associated with a powerful person like Admiral Penn. So it was a joint facade that they erected. Mutually beneficial, indeed.
Oh,
exactly so. Okay, this is William Penn's bookmark, his sticker you put in all his books. And the Latin inscription means, provided that I hold the tiller. Yeah, good democratic phrase I've ever heard. Okay, and the other one, the sort of more patronizing one about mercy and justice. Okay, and it was also on the 18th century maps that were produced in Pennsylvania. He reproduces this coat of arms. And this coat of arms, complete and utter fallacy. They never had a coat of arms. They were not aristocrats, whether that's worth anything or not. It was worth a lot to them. To give them standing. And he always wanted to be an earl. Still used today. Yeah. University of Pennsylvania, they got it stuck on there, this false coat of arms. Yeah. And the Roman Catholic diocese, of all things. Yeah, they got it stuck on there as well. And these are just two examples of how that perpetuates through history. It's falsehood. You've got a little book somewhere, if any. Yeah, three plates are called in heraldic terms, or plates. Okay, so we're coming to William Penn. Okay. Sorry? Give that again? Okay, and we're going to talk about his wife Gully as well and Hannah. Okay? Very difficult to find out too much detail about the women of the time, but I've tried to get what I can to present to you. So William Penn is growing up in a slave-owning household. He knew nothing else apart from being in a household with slaves. Okay. He identifies himself with the aristocracy. That's a class with whom they moved, and they wanted to be associated with through their false coat of arms, etc. Yeah, they were wannabes. Yeah? Yeah. He actually attended the coronation of Charles II. Yeah, a complete monarchist, anti-republican forever. Right? In the same year, he went on a tour of Europe with the aristocrat, the Earl of Crawford. Okay. In 1666, he was then living in Ireland on his father's estates in Ireland and helping his father administer those estates. And the garrison of Carrickfergus in what is now Ulster, the north of Ireland, mutinied. William Penn went with the Earl of Arran. He's not a nice fella. Yeah. At the time, 110 mutineers were court-martialed. They retook the town. The leader, the corporal Dillon, was killed, and 9 people were executed. And Penn exonerated himself and proved himself a great warrior at that time. Okay. And then at 26, when his father died, when the admiral dies, he inherits all the estates in Ireland and in England. And I haven't been able to ascertain all the estates in England, but they were quite significant. Okay. So he becomes a wealthy man. With £1,500 a year income, as an absentee landlord, who we don't like, apparently. Yeah? Absentee landlord, and he has other people collecting the rents off his tenants. Okay? Okay. He had been expelled from Oxford University. All this is the common story of William Penn. Okay, he learned law at Lincoln's Inn in London. He's very skilled, very well educated, as an aristocrat. And he studied in the Huguenot Academy of Saumur. When he went on the European tour, he went to Saumur. And there he went to the Huguenot College, the Protestant College of Saumur.
Why was he expelled from Oxford?
For speaking out against orthodoxy, the Church of England line, the Anglican line. By being a rebel. Okay, he was outspoken. Yeah. No, he became a Quaker later. Yeah, and his time he spent at Saumur was really important. That helped formulate his ideas and his philosophy and outlook on life. Yeah. But as an aristocrat.
At the time,
Outside the official Church of England, you couldn't go to university, you couldn't join the army, civil service, you couldn't join the trade guilds and stuff like that.
Did he get expelled from Oxford while his father was alive?
Yeah, his father's still alive, yeah. And
what did his father do for that?
No, I'll tell you in a minute. Okay, so he converted to Quakerism in Ireland, yeah, and his father was furious, and he tried to disown him, but he couldn't find it within himself to disown his son. Yeah, the whole thing where he beat him up, you know, chucked him out of the house. It was a traumatic time, because his father was part of the establishment, and his son was bucking against that. Yeah, and all that is generally covered in the history of William Penn, you know, and part of the traumas that Penn went through and the persecution he went through, which was real. Because his radical preaching, he often landed in prison. Again, that is well documented and well promoted. And part of the Quaker sufferings.
What did he take issue with?
Well, the Quakers said, the Huguenots would have said, when he was in Saumur, was that you don't need a priest. Yeah, that you can just sit in your own house and communicate directly with God. And God could communicate with you. It's individualism. Okay. Whereas the established Church of England, even today, says, no, you've got to go to church. And it was against the law not to go to church on a Sunday. Okay. You got fined, and all the Quakers got fined, had their lands confiscated, all their tools, all their cattle, everything was confiscated from them. Because they refused to go to church on a Sunday. Along with a lot of other non-conformists, people who did not conform to the Church of England. Baptists, Anabaptists, etc. Okay. So that's what it meant. It meant losing everything. As a consequence of that, the Quakers became a very tight-knit, persecuted community. Okay. They couldn't join guilds, established guilds of manufacturers. So they set up new industries. Very, 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 very like Jewish experience. They set up new trades, so they got involved in the brass and copper trade, which is brand new. They broke the Dutch monopoly there, said right at the beginning, just down the road from where I used to live. And they used their energy in those fields. So he landed in prison quite a few times. So why did he become a leading Quaker? Why did this individual become a leading Quaker? Okay, so it was the repression of the Quakers after the English Revolution, where there were revolutionary men and women, or women and men Quakers, who they said came like a fury from the north of England, and there were thousands and thousands of Quakers and thousands of other nonconformists in the country. They were like a whirlwind from the north, and this shook the establishment. And they were revolutionary, and they wanted paradise and Jerusalem on earth now. Yeah. We are direct descendants from Adam and Eve, and we want to return to the Garden of Eden, where there are no lords, nobody owns anything. You know. Okay, but because of repression, those Quakers, had to defend themselves, and the only way they could defend themselves were people who had influence with the establishment, with the state. And the Penns had that. For two generations they had that. King Charles I and King Charles II. Okay.
There was one interesting point I heard from an ex-housemate of mine who was a Quaker.
Yep.
That he, you know how we have a formal, most languages, like in Spanish, they have instead and they have formal informal. We used to have thee and thou, which we see like the medieval call of thee and thou, that was informal. And you and yours were formal. Mm-hmm. And because the Quakers only use thee and thou because they didn't want to use the formal, they had a reverse effect, and they abolished thee and thou. Is that...
That's probably perverse enough to be true.
Whatever uses thee and thou, I mean, Smedley Butler's parents took thee and thou. Mm. It was not that old.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you go to South Yorkshire or North Derbyshire, then you'll hear people talk to each other. How's that doing? You know, is he all right? You're all right. So it's still used, yeah. Yeah, yeah, but it was a form of not being deferential. So the leading wealthy Quakers who had influence and could protect the dispossessed or the more lowly Quakers took the leadership, not only physically but philosophically, of the Quaker movement, and especially after Naylor being killed. Everybody's heard of Naylor. No. He was a radical Quaker, and he was arrested and tortured, and a burning iron put through his tongue, etc., etc. And that marked the end of radical Quakerism, and this new conservative Quakerism, suppose. It was all part of the counter-revolution after the English Revolution.
Were the Quakers always pacifists, or was it like...
No, the Quakers were revolutionary. The Quakers were members of the new model army, killing the king. Yeah? Now, in the Republic! Okay. So these new lot were more conservative and had an interest in the status quo. Yeah, they were internationally minded, internationally networked. The Quakers were internationally networked, very important. And they had slave trade links. They made the commodities that made the slave system work for Britain. And they had North American ambitions. It wasn't a question of going in and asking for 16,000 quid and getting Pennsylvania. He went in and asked for the land of Pennsylvania. Yeah. He married Gully. Okay, which is a Latin form of the word William. Wimilia is the Latin form of William. Okay, so we'll spring it. And 5 years later, he went to Holland with the established leader, Fox, George Fox. Okay, he wrote, in prison, he wrote The Concessions and Agreements. Quite a famous book that's quite often referred to, you know, about the origin of the Constitution of the United States, etc., or origin of the Charter for Pennsylvania, all those kind of things. And he wrote that, but for the Quakers who were settling in New Jersey, which isn't far. Okay. And just when he acquired Pennsylvania, by that time, his annual income was £2,000 a year. It was a huge amount of money. Huge fortune. Okay. So let's go look at New Jersey. Yeah, it had been given by royal charter to came from the Isle of Jersey, which is why it's called Jersey. And Lord John Berkeley, who's from the southwest of England, his family were Normans. They're both French Norman names. But these are Norman lords from 1066, who still had control of land. And Berkeley was a complete and utter monarchist. He was a committed monarchist, involved in all kinds of plots. When Charles I was about to be executed, he tried to get him away, take him away, abscond him from the parliamentary guard, and that failed. Yeah. And in New Jersey, they sanctioned slavery. Prominent Quakers purchased West Jersey just a couple of years later. Okay, Berkeley's also the proprietor of Carolina, a monarchist gift. Okay. And Penn calls in his debt for 16,000 quid and obtains Pennsylvania. Penn's already visited New Jersey. He's involved in New Jersey. New Jersey was transferred from Carteret and Berkeley to two levelers. Two levelers who were members of the New Model Army. Two leveler officers. Okay? So he's visited there. He's been involved in all the negotiations. He was the go-between between the levelers and the two lords who owned New Jersey.
This is like sort of bottom line. These are levelers and they're dealing with boys.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they're not sort of levelers anymore,
no.
Are they?
No. No, they're not.
Excellent.
No. They're trying to make the best of a bad job. You're talking about the time of counter-revolution. So people change under repression. The repression was huge. Okay. Expansionist plans of the Quakers. Complete. So this is a scheme they had, yeah? Yeah, he also gained Delaware from his friend the Duke of York, the future James II. Yeah, and he became the sole proprietor of 40,000 square miles, which is just less than the size of England. It's the size of Pennsylvania, in comparison to where he came from. practically the size of England, Pennsylvania, especially with Delaware. And then in the same year, East Jersey is also purchased by the Quakers. Okay. Okay, so the Quakers own all of New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware. Okay, just the English in the audience. Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware. Big population of Quakers in New York, who were later expelled from New York through repression, and thousands of Quakers left New York State and came to Pennsylvania. Okay, and also a hell of a lot on Rhode Island. Okay, so he's got his new colony, and he needs to populate it, and he developed promotional literature, and this map that was developed in 1861 is one of the maps that he had drawn up to show an empty land. Okay. So this is New Jersey here. Okay. On the eastern side. Yeah. Purposely showed an empty land, you know, where the people of Northern Europe could come and experience great time and become wealthy. The American dream. Yeah, he wrote Glowing Prospectus. He marketed it through Europe. He visited Europe and all his Quaker and Lutheran and other nonconformists, and of course his family in Germany, he visited them as well, and they marketed it as well. Okay. When, during the course of immigration to Pennsylvania, merchants went there, agents of merchants would go and go around Eastern Europe and dress up in the finest clothes and wear a lot of gold, and say, "This is how we all live in Pennsylvania." Sign here, please. Okay? And they were paid to come over. In Amsterdam, where a lot of nonconformists went to from all over what is now Germany and Holland, people congregated in Amsterdam to get protection from oppression, all the Lutherans, etc., etc. Amish, older. To get rid of them, because the Amsterdam authorities did not want all these nonconformists there, they worked with a Scottish bank called the Hope Bank. Okay. And the Hope Bank were paid 60 guilders per head by the Amsterdam authorities for every nonconformist they took over Pennsylvania. It's a business, it's a banking business. The Hope Bank then allied themselves later on with Barings, the Baring brothers, who became Barings Bank. The Hope Bank and the Barings Bank were involved in the purchase of Louisiana. Yeah. They're big players. Very, very rapid development of capital at this time.
Did have anything to
do with Donut
or Swarm?
Well, I don't know.
I don't know.
So, a question.
Yep.
That map doesn't seem to go very far west.
No, no. No, because the bite-sized, bite-sized stuff, wasn't it? Yeah, he had this land the size of England, pretty much. Yeah, but it's occupied.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's occupied by Native Americans. Yeah. So he's showing this is what we're doing. Yeah, and he did all his negotiations
with.
Yeah. It's the southeast of Pennsylvania. Okay. What I'm gonna do is give you some cards, right? You individually and come up, pick up a card and have all these slides, okay? And I'll email them to you. Okay. So you can have a look at your ledger, because you know this state better. Okay, you promised religious freedom. Yeah, obviously, and material advantage. Okay, but there was counter propaganda going around as well, saying, "Don't believe the fairy tales you're hearing about Pennsylvania, because it is forested. You've got to clear all the forests, all the fields, etc., etc."
Who is
Various people in Germany, especially. They're saying, don't believe it, it's a lie. You know, we know people have been there and have returned, and it's not the land of opportunity. You're there and you're going to live in terrible conditions, and you've got land, yeah, but it's forested. Okay, so you offer them cheap land, 40 shillings an acre, 100 acres, yeah, and thousands of people were induced to come to Pennsylvania from Northern Europe. It was a business. Okay, you all familiar with that map?
Yeah.
This is Holmes' promotional map of Philadelphia. So this was taken around Europe as well. That's why he had it drawn up. In the first 6 months, he sold 300,000 acres to about 250 settlers, and most of them were rich London Quakers. So Pennsylvania there were lots of Europeans in Pennsylvania when he took it over, and a lot of them were Quakers. So he's developing this new city where we are right now. And the first people he went to were the rich Quakers with whom he associated as a wannabe husband. Okay. They had large mansions. They had the prime choice places in Pennsylvania, on the rivers or in this new city. Yeah. They bought the frames of their houses from Europe. Yeah, they brought all the furniture, everything, for their houses. Now, rich people, they can't make shit, can they? So they also need a lot of other people to come and do the work. Yeah. Okay. No point in having fine mansions and then starving to death. Okay. So remember Captain William Crispin? Let's go to the flashback. There's the Crispins. Became Quakers, yeah. So he's the great uncle of William Penn, okay, who'd been involved in the Jamaica thing, fight against the Dutch with his father. Okay. He was offered a senior post in New Pennsylvania and purchased 5,000 acres of land. Hell of a lot. But he died en route, I think I mentioned earlier, to America. His land went to his elder children. And he had lots in this city. They were given lots in this city. Because they're his in-laws. His younger children, because he had two wives, his younger children lived in Kinsale, that significant port in Ireland. Yeah. And Penn gave them 3,000 acres each in Pennsylvania. So he's gifting out land. Okay, home of the brave, land of the free. But in dealing with his own class, here's an example. The Penn family received £40 from the bearer for a lady in England who intends to go over soon with her family, and many considerable persons are likely to follow. She has bought 5,500 acres, and her first 300 must be chosen on the river next to Arthur Cook's. So they, you know. These are well-to-do London people who are choosing the prime spots in this new colony that is supposed to be the promised land for everyone. Mm-hmm. So for the numerous poor people who came from Northern Europe, people have been persecuted and suffered ignominies that we cannot imagine. Being cleared off the land through enclosures all across Northern Europe. Because the old system is breaking down. That created a large class of landless men, women, and children. Yeah, and were ready to seek new homes. Scotland, Ireland, Northern Germany, etc. Okay, so they came from all those countries. Yeah, as well as thousands of Quakers and other Protestants. There came Catholics as well. And Jews. It's significant to mention that. The poor lived in turf houses. Do anybody know about this? How the poor people live? Yeah, no, I don't want to. Yeah. They lived. Yeah. Atrocious, terrible conditions. While they were clearing the timber from the land and digging up all the stumps, planting, and waiting for the returns on the crop and then selling the crop and living. And they couldn't have done that without the support of the Native Americans who lived here. just like in early Virginia, in Jamestown.
There's some story, I think it was, of Penn or one of his family coming in, finding everybody living in the caves by the river and being outraged at how bad it looked.
Yeah.
Giving
yeah.
money to build people houses.
Yeah, like homeless people, you know, ruined over.
Yeah, just
get
them out of this.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
This was the first thing you
yeah.
saw. Was
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Was
yeah.
Caves.
Yeah. Living, built into the sides of rivers. Caves, you know.
Well, they said they used to have sort of cliffs along the Delaware that had been leveled, so there was, I guess, more room to compete in the
yeah. yeah. Yeah, toddler-like living.
The banks were higher than
yeah. yeah. And a lot of turf, a lot of turf housing. Okay. Penn, however, yeah, lived in his new mansion in Pensbury and had all the furniture and all the stuff brought over because he wanted to live the life of a grandee. It was 60 feet by 40 feet, not a turf hut by any stretch of imagination, cost £7,000. It's just King's Ransom. Yeah. 3,400 acres.
He was a Quaker fuel, basically.
He was, yeah. Yeah, yeah, he was proprietor in the
like
Royal Manor.
Here, but you could go through Maine, I guess.
Yeah.
And a lot of like the Amish and
yeah.
you know, other, the non-conformists who said, they came through and they said, okay, we'll just go west. I mean,
yeah.
Like
yeah.
Started
yeah.
Keep
yeah.
West,
yeah.
West.
Yeah. So his scheme with his, he didn't act alone, right? He had his family, his in-laws, all the connections he had. They were going to run this colony. It was a Quaker colony on Quaker standards. Okay. They'd have other religions in, but primarily it's a Quaker tenets. And they were going to all pay what's called a quick rent, which is an old feudal kind of rent, where yeah, okay, you can buy the you can purchase the land off me, yeah, or whatever per 100 acres, but then you'll also pay me an annual rent because I actually still own the right to the land.
Mm-hmm.
You can do whatever you like on the land, but when it comes down to it, bottom line, just
it's
like
still
a king,
yeah.
it's still mine. I am the proprietor of this, and I have the royal charter to prove it. And also the mineral rights. Yeah? Also the mineral rights. It was a very rich colony.
New Jersey had iron. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll come on to that in the second half of the talk.
Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, yeah, it wasn't a purely agricultural colony by any stretch of imagination. But of course, you probably all know he didn't stay around for long in Pennsylvania. He didn't actually spend much time here, even though he's honored to the extreme. He returned to England, didn't return, he had an absence of 15 years. He returned in 99. Yeah. In the Glorious Revolution, you all heard of the Glorious Revolution? William and Mary. Yeah, yeah. Where King James II is overthrown by the Dutch cousin, his Dutch cousin, who's backed by the grandees of England to overthrow a supposed Catholic king and introduce a strict Protestant king and a constitutional king, which is exactly what Parliament tells him to do, and his wife Mary. Okay, because he'd backed James II, yeah, the Catholic king, he has to go into hiding. He's arrested for corresponding with the king as well.
He's
a critic.
He's like a Protestant, so why would he be on the side of the...
Yeah, it does seem weird for
yeah,
a
bit of
a
little bit
monarchy.
Of... Yeah, well, there you go.
A lot of duplicity is going on.
A lot of duplicity.
A lot about the convenience
yeah.
of the association, not about the ideals, really. Or the enemy.
Perhaps
the
if I scratch your back, you might scratch my back.
Yep.
He's only got the province because of a royal charter. He can't fall out with the people who sign his charter, otherwise he could say... Yeah. Although he's charging quick rents and he has the land, below that there's another level of ownership, which is the British state. Yeah. And they can just say, got your charter, thank you very much. Go on, lad. Right. Okay. James II lands in Ireland. To try and reinvade England, yeah. And Penn is arrested by Queen Mary. He's tried but acquitted. He's a very, very good lawyer. trained lawyer. Okay? Okay, so he's in hiding, charged with treason. The king, at that point, takes back Pennsylvania. Yeah? Because he has an underlying proprietorship. Yeah. No, it's King William now. Yes, yeah, King William takes back Pennsylvania. He's declared a traitor in Ireland, loses a lot of his estates, although some of them are given back later, because it's a club. Yeah. It's a club of aristocrats, and that's what they did. Yeah. And Pennsylvania returns to his authority a couple of years later, in 1694. Okay, he returns. 5 years later, after being given back Pennsylvania, it takes him 5 years to come back here. But by that time, it's all gone out of his control. I mean, even by the first time, it was 19 years previously, he knew that his utopian vision, which you could call a foolish, stupid vision, if you were so-minded, that you're going to create this utopia in Pennsylvania when there's all this stuff going on in the world. You could control everything. Have a little fiefdom. Yeah, the Assembly now run the colony. He himself tried to sell Pennsylvania back to the Crown, 1712. Yeah, and then he has one of his strokes, heart attacks. And his wife takes over managing his affair, Hannah, who I'll tell you a little about in a minute. Yeah. He dies in 1718. He's buried next to his first wife, Gully, in the Quaker Cemetery of Jordans, which is in Berkshire. Well, she died. His first wife died. William Penn dies and is buried in the plot next to his wife. And then when his second wife dies, she's buried next to him. Buried. Okay, these markers are new. Quakers didn't have markers. All these are new markers, sort of Victorian stuff. Okay. So Gully married him. Her family were revolutionary Puritans. Mother became a Quaker when her husband died. She married William Penn in 1772 and died in 1794. And that's like an image of her, but providence is dubious. Hannah, his second wife. Remember all those streets in Bristol? The Callowhill streets?
Yeah.
The Callowhill.
Yeah, Callowhill. Oh, you joking? You give me a laugh. Come on. Yeah. Well, there you go.
Not far.
There you go.
It's above Morgan.
There you go. Okay, he married her when she was 24 and he was 52, so it was obviously love at first sight. Maids, when you're young, never marry an old man. Okay. And she added considerable wealth and land ownership to the Penn family. Okay, they were big landowners in the north of Bristol, where they were. Yeah.
Hollister is her marriage?
Yeah, no. Callowhill is her family name.
Okay.
And she married. No, sorry. Hollister is her family name. Dennis Hollister. Dennis Hollister, yeah. And she married Callowhill.
Okay.
No, Callowhill's a maiden name, sorry. Then she married Hollister, and then she married.
So she's that's her second marriage.
Yeah. Yeah. People died. You know.
People died.
People died. Yeah. The Quakers used marriage. The Quakers used marriage to build business connections. Yeah. There was a network of cousinhood which stretched right across the New World and the Old World. Yeah, and they're all interrelated.
I mean, did anyone not? Right.
No, you ought to marry within the Quaker faith.
Yeah.
If you married outside the Quaker faith, you were expelled from the faith.
They did that here too. Yeah. Kicked you out of the meeting house.
Sorry.
I mean, in general.
People could marry their cousins, but they had a network of cousinhood, which meant that they could trade internationally. Yeah, they had a family networks at a time when there were no banks. And so who could you trust? You only trust your family. So you've got a relative in Jamaica producing stuff. Okay, you've got long lines of credit. You're delivering stuff down through the west coast of Africa, and then it has to go all the way over to Jamaica. and then it still has them all the way from Jamaica or wherever, you know, the new colonies, all the way back to England, and that's taken months and months and months. You have to have people you can trust in all those places. And who better to trust than an honest Quaker? And Quakers were honest. They were people of their word, with some exceptions. Yeah? But generally speaking, in a land of duplicity, Quakers were regarded as honest. And that's how they become major finances in the world. Yeah? Again, similar to the Jewish experience. Yeah?
Well, they were persecuted first, so they came together. And the thing is, too, is like, yeah.
We have the same thing in England, it's called Norfolk.
Second cousins. It happens. I mean, it's still happening. I mean, it's happened
yeah.
at the
yeah.
beginning of the century.
Yeah.
It's sort of,
yeah.
It
perpetuates.
Yeah.
Perpetuates.
So because, like,
absolutely.
People were like living in very like closely knit communities, so it was almost like partially was establishing connections, probably it was just like you're all closely knit.
No, yeah, no, they did it for financial reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the financial reasons was preeminence. If there was no money in it, they wouldn't do it. It didn't matter for luck. Didn't say, I really, really love you. No. They went, Have you met my daughter? Do you think that'd be a good marriage? I think it could be. That could be a good little connection. Yeah, because she's got relatives out in Massachusetts. Yeah. That's why they're married. That's why she married a 52-year-old bloke. Okay, when William Penn died, his son William Jr. Sort of obtained control of the colony, but he was unsuccessful. And Hannah herself remained in charge until she died. She was executor of the will, and she controlled this colony for a number of years. Okay. There's Jordan's burial site. Just hope to show you a few pictures of that. Sandra and I. Hi, Sandra. Sandra and I visited the other week and took some photographs for you. And there's the other one, marked, right? And there's a meeting house, very similar to buildings out here. Yeah, Quaker building houses, meeting houses. There's the inside, no ornamentation. Yeah. There's an old Quaker sitting down there reading a book. Okay. So, I mean, we are struck, I think, aren't we? As English people, are struck by the architecture around here. We could be walking through just the squares you've got. Washington Square is exactly like Queen Square in Bristol. The layout, the feel of it, the texture of the buildings.
So did Penn have slaves here too?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so we've got his son, two of his sons. Yeah. But do you want to have a break? You want a quick coffee? Or do you want to carry on?
Let's keep going.
Yeah. Let's keep going! To the end!
Got a little noise in the background.
Well, the sons get a bad name because of the walking purchase.
Oh, good. I hope somebody knew about that.
Okay. Well, they tell us. It was like, well, it was, you know, the degenerate William Penn was good, but, you know, you can't control your kids.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
not his fault.
Yeah. That's what they say. Yeah, that's how good Penn was. Couldn't control the colony, couldn't control his kids.
His father couldn't.
Why did he think they had this idea of setting up this peaceful place? I don't know. Okay.
The French and Indian War.
Yeah.
See how peaceful Pennsylvania was.
Exactly. So John Penn, eldest son of William and Hannah, was actually raised in Hannah's family in Bristol. Okay. And he learned the trade of a linen merchant. Very little on him, what he did in Bristol. But I can tell you that by that time, there was growing use of flax. Flax is used to make linen. Yeah, it was a major crop, especially in Ireland. Irish linen. Yeah, and also in Germany. We know that a German linen was imported to Bristol and was then re-exported as part of the slave trade. So he must have been part of that. And they got all the German connections. His whole family is either part German or part Dutch.
Okay.
Yeah, through the mothers. No, through the mothers, through the admirals' marriages. Okay. He inherits half of Pennsylvania. Okay. And so he's in England, being brought up, learning to be a linen merchant. And he has to come over to Pennsylvania to sort out the dispute with Lord Baltimore. Yeah, you all know about that, pretty much. Yeah, Maryland dispute. So Maryland want their state to be up to here, which includes the city, right? And the Penns want to claim all the land down here. Okay. And they ended up with the, what was the line going across?
Mason-Dixon
line! Which became a significant fault line in America. Yeah, the slavery, pro-slavery anti-state. Okay, like an 80-year dispute, the whole thing was an 80-year dispute. And erupted in how do you pronounce that? Cressap? Cressap's War? You heard of that? Cressap's War? Oh, he was a rogue who worked for Lord Baltimore and did various raids on Pennsylvania.
Yeah. There were New Englanders who were coming down who also claimed
Pennsylvania. Yeah. It was all weird, a weird, uncertain time because the borders were so uncertain. So he's establishing taking over villages and stuff and having a pop at Pennsylvania on behalf of Lord Baltimore. And there's lots of skirmishes and it was called the war.
So I assume that Baltimore was named after Lord Baltimore.
Cressap was working for Lord Baltimore?
Yeah. Yeah. He was like a mercenary, if you like, in today's term. Yeah. Troublemaker, trying, you know, as a bargaining tool. Okay, Thomas is responsible for the walking purchase. Very well done. Top mark, 10 out of 10 there. And more about that soon. He's buried at Jordan's. And he left his half of Pennsylvania to his brother Thomas. And there's his marker stone in the same Jordan cemetery. Okay, so Thomas, son of William Penn. Okay, and brother of John. Very grand there. It's very controversial in white Pennsylvania affairs. Okay. He weakened or eliminated the assembly's power. He only ran the colony. He appointed governors and ran the colony through that. He was trying to circumvent the assembly, the democratic, white democratic assembly of Pennsylvania. And he imposed an autocratic rule. He's trying to be a dictator. He's trying to get back to being a proprietor. Okay, continue the family tradition of ownership. You know that at least in 1733 he bought a man called Virgil. He bought a man called Virgil from one Joseph Wardner. So, Admiral Penn, William Penn had a slave plantation and his sons continued that. So it wasn't that his sons went wrong. They were carrying on a tradition. They carried on the family tradition of appropriation by force. He and John eventually renounced Quakerism, and Thomas himself bought strict religious freedom in Pennsylvania, including Quakers himself.
And Virgil was the name.
Yeah. That's the name. Yeah. Slave owner name. Okay, he was an opponent of Benjamin Franklin. Himself a slave owner, yeah. So I'm pleased to see he's now recognized in the center of town. Yeah, and he was also an opponent of the revolution, an opponent of any move for greater democracy. They were autocrats. Okay. In fact, Franklin organized the Quaker Party in opposition to the Penns and their faction. Yeah. Okay. These people who came to Pennsylvania believed the world was 5,000 years old. Yeah? They believed that you could trace everybody back to Adam and Eve. And everybody's descended from Adam and Eve. And they so working logically with the world's population that they calculated, they said, okay, going back, two people, it must be 5,000 years old. Okay, and they invaded the land where people had lived for 10,000 years. It's kind of interesting. And so, yeah. They believe in that the future was predestined. Yeah. Anything that happened in the future was part of God's plan. So anything we did was part of God's plan. And that's how they justified what they did. If it's happening and it works and it makes money, we must be doing God's will. Otherwise, it wouldn't be profitable. So slavery is justified in those terms. Appropriation, displacement of native populations, etc. Clearance of land in England, Scotland, Ireland is justified by doing God's will. Cool. Yeah, the people fought against that. I really believe that. Okay. And in fact, Franklin sought to have the colony become so against what the Penns were doing. He'd rather have the colony revert back to the ownership by the royal state. So the walking purchase. So hands up those people who had the walking purchase. Oh, yeah. English people as well, though. Okay. So we just have a quick look then at the role of the two brothers, for those who don't know. Okay. The Delaware Native Americans were forced to agree to fraudulent purchase of their land. Penn brothers claimed their father had made an agreement that you could negotiate with the Native Americans and you could then purchase the land that you walk in a day and a half. From sunrise to sunset and then the following day for another 6 hours. Yeah. Penn brothers with their Quaker secretary James Logan planned everything concerning the walk in advance. So they knew the fraud that they were going to bring about, and they already had people signed up to buy that land. Oh yeah, oh yeah. He was there. He was there at the start of the war.
Is that when Logan Circle was named?
Yes. More than likely, Paul.
Because he was supposed to be this big intellectual and such a noble person.
But you can be an intellectual when you've got money to spend time being intellectual and not be ground down every day to work, don't you? Yeah? You can have the philosophical society down the road, don't you? Yeah, when you've got money. Of course, working people are philosophical as well. Different philosophy, that's. So they chose three runners to meet at the Friends meeting house. It's called Wrightstown. Yeah? Yeah. Okay, they are pacemakers on horseback. And they're going along in what's called an Indian trail. Okay, so it's a path. Okay, so there are three people, only Edward Marshall keeps going. Edward Marshall became, you heard of him? He became a very famous Indian fighter. Yeah, and his rifle is in one of the museums in that part of Pennsylvania, I can't remember the name of the museum now. And his rifle's in there, and it's supposed to have shot more people than any other rifle.
There's a Marshall Road not too far in Upper Darby, just on the fringe of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And Baltimore Avenue, which I live on, is actually connects to Route 1, which is one of the first roads in America.
Right.
And it's an old Indian trail.
There you go.
Germantown used to, I think. A lot, I think yeah. It's
diagonal. Yeah.
Yeah, the streets that are off the grid are definitely.
Yeah. Because they're natural paths through physical obstacles, aren't they? Yeah. Okay. Through this, instead of walking, they'd run, right? With pacemakers and horseback, right? They gained three quarters of a million acres of land. And it's prime land, it's corn growing land and prime hunting land for the indigenous people. Comes into their family ownership. Okay, Marshall himself gets money in 500 acres in Portland. Yeah, little village of Portland. And that's where the gun is. It's around there, a little museum. South Bucks Heritage Museum or something. And I can't remember now. Thomas's fortune grows because he sells off all his land. But he'd already had the contract signed before they set off. He gained all his land. Okay, 4 years later, he cares so much about this land, he goes to England. And once more, an absentee landlord. Okay? So this is the land we're talking about. And this is the Delaware River going up here. This is Williamstown here. And they set off down that path, that wavy, wavy land. It takes a day and a half to do it. Okay. By about this point, the Native Americans say, this isn't walking. This is running your heart out and being paced by horses. And there's two guys dropped, you know, one of them fell in a river and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, and they give up in disgust and say, it's just another fraud. And they carried on all the way up to this point here. Native Americans are expecting a line at right angles to the Delaware River. But in actual fact, the surveyors draw a line up to the Delaware River here. So they take even more land. Yeah. Okay. So nearly 1,200 square miles it's taken from. You pronounce it Lenape?
Yes.
Yeah, Lenape people are also called the Delaware Indians because they live near. Okay, and that's about the size of Rhode Island. So you have an idea of the size of the land that they defrauded.
So the Lenape and the Delaware were the same thing. Yeah. I thought the Delaware were on the eastern side and the Lenape were.
Oh, right.
No, they were called, they described the Lord Delaware. That's how they got the name.
They're Lenape.
Yeah.
That's what they call themselves.
They're not Auburn people.
Oklahoma.
So in general, yeah. Delaware is a larger term, and Lenape is a more specific term.
Right.
The ones who kind of like reclaim,
yeah.
Yeah, Anadarko. Yeah. Those are the ones. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's also one in the Moravian, I think the Moravian Delaware, the Moravian area. So, yeah,
yeah. Okay. Yeah, and all that. Fraudulence sparks off wars. Yeah. Marshall, the guy who took the land, his family are killed by the Native Americans, wiped out, and that's why he became such a vehement, as I say, that's why he became such a vehement Indian killer. Mm-hmm. Okay. But it sparked it. That was the end. That was the break in any kind of trust. I mean, there wasn't much trust in the Indians. People were trying to make the best recovery of that position continually and being pushed back. Then the Native Americans allied themselves with the French and they were more against the English. Yeah, that was choose a side. Okay, so Thomas Penn inherited half of Pennsylvania when his brother John, who I talked about earlier, died. And he married Lady Juliana Fermor, daughter of Earl of Pomfret. Yeah, the ex. Achieve what they always wanted. Lords. Yeah, man. Yeah, that's what it was all about. He lived out his estate, his days in his large estate in Stoke Poges. And that's the manor that he lived in. Okay. Native Americans came over, increasing pressure of white encroachment, a series of wars. He didn't care, he's back in England. He didn't care. Made his bucks before the people legged it back. His son John Penn, okay, so this is the grandson of William Penn, inherited half of Pennsylvania and the governorship of the province for age 15. 15-year-old kid. Yeah, he went to Eton School. Preacher, why do you scoff at the word Eton School? The rich scum. So, are you Americans heard of Eton School?
Oh, yeah.
Eton Rifles. Oh, yeah.
Eton
Rifles? Yeah, it's a huge public school, which means private school in England. Right next to Windsor Castle and right next to Stoke Poges.
Well, we have public schools here, so, I mean, our public schools. Yeah.
All pretty much all the Tory, all the Conservative cabinet went to eat. It's a boys' club. Yeah. And half of Labour. He also went to Cambridge University. Okay. In 1786, and we'd like to thank you, take this opportunity to thank you for the money that your new nation, the American Commonwealth, gave to the Penns for the loss of their own colony, which was never theirs in the first place. So there's 9,000, there's 16,000 quid return. Yeah, it's not bad, is it? 16,000 pounds his grandfather had given to Charles is now, he's now compensated 130,000 pounds. He claimed well over £1 million. From the new Commonwealth Assembly.
So was he appointed governor by Washington?
No, that was it. No, they opposed it. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
They opposed it. The Quakers had lost control. The Quakers opposed the American Revolution. Yeah. The guys who were in Pennsylvania who supported the revolution were the German immigrants. Yeah. Because they were treated so badly by the Quakers that they said, well, sod that, we're going to support the revolution.
Most of Harvard, they went.
Yeah,
to
legged it.
Yeah.
Treacherous
dogs, but
yeah.
Anyway, they.
In England, we call it bottling, don't we? They lost their bottle. Yeah, they legged it.
But some Quakers, they were fighting Quakers. They went with the American Revolution.
Okay, so on top of the compensation from your government, he also was awarded £4,000 per year. By the English Parliament, for his loss. No. Nope. So that's an extra 176,000 quid. Right. So he back to the Stoke Poges, his father's mansion. He demolishes three quarters of that. And he built Stoke Park Mansion, and he becomes a dilettante. He develops a centre for poetry and music and fine arts. Beautifully landscaped estates, etc. He clears all the people off the estates as parks. Yeah. Capability Brown, you heard of him? The great landscape gardener in England? No, forget it.
He wanted to be up with the fashion, so he demolished the old buildings.
Yeah.
Were there farmers working on this estate?
Yeah.
And then he kicked them all.
He kicks them all off to have a nice lawns where people can come and have music.
The guys that convert land into deer parks.
Yeah. Although he didn't want deer or sheep, he just wanted nice, refined people walking around his estate, you know, rather like the French aristocracy of theirs. Yeah, don't want those. So there's the manor house today, and it's in the grounds of Stoke Park Mansion, which looks surprisingly like a building in Washington. Okay, it's now a golf course and conference centre, and lots of films have been shot around James. Massive. Yeah, the grounds are so massive.
So some of that was built with American money.
Yeah. And if you stand there and look directly out, Layer Cake, the other film that was filmed there. Yeah. But if you stand there and look out, you can see Windsor Castle, one of the Queen's castles. Yeah. And between that estate and Windsor Castle, there's Eton School.
Oh my God.
So he's right up there. Here's the back of it. But we're in a republic!
Actually, I guess you have people do. Chris, Martin McGuinness is going to shake the Queen's hand, so I guess nothing really changes.
No. It's all there, isn't it? There's a couple of shots of the interior, and there's my mother-in-law there. I don't know if she's in there. So we snuck in there and took a few photographs. Just to give you an idea of the size, the grandness inside. And this is the time so this is the time of the slave state, displaced Native Americans. This is what it's all about having grand palaces. Yeah. About indentured servants who have no rights whatsoever, people forced into labour, Native Americans being enslaved in this state, all that kind of stuff. Great to slide. We had good fun sliding down that banister, didn't we? Just give an idea where it is. There's a burial ground, and right next door to it is Stoke Poges, where he had the big estate and mansion. Okay. He was appointed High Sheriff of Buckinghamshire. It's like an honorary position.
What's he doing in Cornwall?
Yeah, exactly. He's just a rotten butter. Do you know what a rotten butter is?
No, it's guaranteed, right?
Guaranteed, yeah. There's nobody lives there. It's just a town with nobody lives there, no boats. Right? So you just get it. It's just a way of becoming an MP. So there are corrupt boroughs and rotten boroughs. And, okay.
Jim, I'll sound good example. One borough, right?
Oh, one Middlesbrough.
Two MPs, one voter.
Yeah.
That's a rotten borough.
Two MPs, and there's only one voter in the borough.
Okay. Oh, my God.
Yeah. It's a scam. It's a scam. They ran it. No, he had nothing to do with Cornwall. It's just it came up for grabs, and that was the way into Parliament, so he can get influence. And one of the influences he had was he was awarded governorship of Portland by Prime Minister Pitt. Okay, governorship of Portland, in command of the local.
Portland in Pennsylvania?
No, it's not in Pennsylvania. It's in England, on the Solway. Okay, and so he's governor of the Isle of Portland, Dorset, and he's gifted that land by George III. So he's given money by a king, given land by a king. Does that sound a bit familiar?
Mm-hmm.
You guys? So it all happens again. And he builds Pennsylvania Castle. Oh, what else is he going to call it? Yeah, he knows his roots. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There still is no trees in Sylvania.
So they've gone from Charles the First to George the
Fifth. Yeah. 260 years we're doing here, proper history. Okay. He encloses the many acres of land around the castle, kicks everybody off. Again. Okay. That's what they always do. The whole family have done that right from his great grandfather in 19 in Wiltshire. Okay? So that's what they did. There were enclosures of land, enslavers of people. Okay. Slavery, Pennsylvania Quakers. Okay. Are we okay for time? Can you keep going?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay, less interruptions, but more discourse. Okay. He looked upon a slave not as the property of the master, but as a member of the family. Okay. That's patronized, that's benevolent colonial. Yeah, and that's the same attitude he had to the Native Americans. He's a close friend of the Duke of York, later James II. Remember how he got put in prison for supporting James II in the Glorious Revolution? Great mates. Because he was great mates of his dad's. Okay, the Duke's given New Amsterdam. Yeah. New York State is called New Amsterdam. Yeah, Dutch possession. Okay. Under Dutch ownership, now the Dutch had slaves in New Amsterdam, but they had what could be described as half freedom. It wasn't total enslavement. I mean, people were slaves, beat about the bush, but they had some limited freedom of movement, freedom of expression, etc. And under British rule, they lost that because the British introduced chattel slavery. You were totally owned by your owner. No question about it. You were direct property of an individual, and you could be bought and sold, and your family could be bought and sold in perpetuity. Yeah? It's different from other slave systems. It's a new form of ownership. And it's part of the new capitalist system. Whether they knew it or not, they were part of the new capitalist system. Okay, 1701, he actually wrote that all his blacks will become free when he died. Okay, I'm going to own you while I'm alive, but I'm going to die, being a nice guy.
How many did he own?
We don't know. But he said to become free when he died. He also wrote that his indentured servants will be free after they completed their indentureship. This is in his will. Yeah, so you can't move out the land. You can't move away to another parish or another borough or whatever. Yeah. County, that's the word, yeah. You can't move out to another county without permission of the people who own the county. You're stuck. You're passed, aren't you? Okay. These clauses were omitted from all his later wills. Okay. He wrote at least another two wills after that. And so he's getting some kind of realism. Actually, we need this slave labor. And we need this indentured service. Yeah? to run this column. Okay. Slave ownership is in the first frame of, it's enshrined in the first frame of government that he drew up with his Quaker associates. Okay. And they were confronted with a rapidly growing province, an acute shortage of labour. Land was cheap. They promoted the whole thing on cheap land, relatively cheap land, which meant that people could, you know, anybody who worked for somebody, once they got some money, they could go off and buy some land. So those people who were working for in the first place lost that labour. Yeah? So the cheap land worked against them. So they turned to slave labour, and also directly importing slaves from Africa. Yeah. For example, his agent, Philip Lenmain, yeah, he used the Isabella to trade for slaves. James Claypool, the other Claypool family.
Yeah, okay.
They're still around. Yeah. Significant participants in the slave trade and use of slaves. Not only in Pennsylvania, but elsewhere. Okay, yeah. In fact, yeah, James had a brother in Barbados. He had a plantation in Barbados, and he imported slaves into Pennsylvania to his brother. Penn himself is actively dealing in slaves and buying a number from Captain Nathan Allen. Okay, he's also selling slaves. He sold one person for a full price, for the man would expect it of me. Okay. He's got a good price for his slaves. Because yeah, it would be insulting to a slave not to get the full price in his work. Yeah. It's funny way of looking at life. Okay. By 1687, he decided his plantation should only use slave labour. So, Penbury Mansion. Anybody visited there?
Yeah.
I haven't been there.
Oh, yeah, there's a huge
mountain. It's my first day in Pennsylvania.
Is it a landfill, you say?
Yeah. Where is it?
It's pretty far north.
It's in Buckingham.
Yeah, in Buckinghamshire County. Buckinghamshire County, where Stoke Poges is and the Quaker burial ground is in Buckingham County.
So they got bucks from Buckinghamshire?
Yeah. Yeah.
In 1688, the Quakers in Pennsylvania published an official protest.
Yeah. Yeah. They did? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it was one.
Yeah. Yeah, we're talking about Penn at the moment. We'll come on to Quakers in a second. Okay, so for example, as Yaff and Chevalier mentioned, is Penn's favourite servants, and they often use the word servant to mean slave. It was that patronising thing that you mentioned, and the way of salving their own consciences. Mm. Yeah? So it's very difficult to calculate the number of slaves that Quakers or Penn owned, because they often called them servants. Okay. There was Trish, who was a personal servant of Penn's daughter, Letitia. There's supposed to be work going on at Pennsbury. He actually said in a letter about the change from indentured labour to slave labour. It's better they are blacks, but then a man has them while they live. But forever. And their descendants. So why that isn't up in the street? Makes you think. That was a powerful statement. So this aristocrat Penn thought slave plantation was a natural inheritance for his children. They weren't just wayward kids, he brought them up. And they're living on his plantation with slave labour. Yeah, he said, "Let my children be husbandmen and housewives. This leads to consider the works of God and nature, and diverts the mind from being taken up with the vain arts and inventions of a luxurious world. A country life and estates I like best for my children." He's talking about a slave plantation after displacing people, financed to a great extent from enclosure in Ireland and from estates in England. That's the mentality of a guy. So, to the Crispin family, yeah, his in-laws. Yeah, were also slave owners and had white labourers who ran away. And these two descendants of Captain Crispin, both called Silas. Yeah, he left his wife, his Negro's household, or gods, should be goods, sorry, etc. And another Silas said, I give my Negro girl Dinah to my wife. Yeah, and when she's 24 years old, then I shall give the said Negro girl to my daughter Sarah, to her heirs and assigns forever. Okay, these are the in-laws of William Penn, who had influence over his children. And it's an advert for a runaway indentured labourer of Silas Crispin. And a great description. And in the end, there's a £3 reward, yeah? For turning him in. But a lot of indentured slave labourers ran away. So slave dealing was a lucrative business for some American and English Quakers. Some, not all, but a significant number of Quakers. Okay. In 1756, there are 84 Quakers listed as being members of the company trading to Africa, the English company. Okay. And if you join that company, if you're admitted into that company, you can join the slave trade. And in 1756, there are 84 Quakers listed as members trading in the African slave trade. Fledgling international banks, and I mentioned this earlier, I mentioned Barings Bank and the Hope Bank. This massive, massive development of resources and movement of goods meant you ought to have credit and you ought to have banks, and you established the Bank of England and all the rest of it, and the stock exchange came into existence all through this international trade. So banks came into existence. And we look at the Barclay family. You heard of Barclay's Bank? Yes. English Bank? Yes. Yeah. Not only Barclay's Bank, Lloyd's Bank?
Yes.
Yeah. National Westminster Bank?
Yeah.
Yeah. All originally Quaker banks. Yeah. And they got their money through international trades, trade in slaves and the value produced by the labour of slaves. Barclays itself got into serious trouble. A lot of people in England boycotted Barclays Bank because of involvement in apartheid in South Africa. Yeah, a long commission, never give it up. So there's two brothers, David and Alexander. Yeah. Many of the ships which transported settlers to England, from England to American colonies, were owned by the Barclay family. Great number. Not all, but great number. David Barclay, his commerce revolved around the American and West Indian trade. He's one of the most influential merchants of his day. A mover and a shaker. Oh, quick. His father owned a large slave plantation in Jamaica. And who took Jamaica for the British?
His father.
Admiral Sir William Penn. The Barclays intermarried with other Quaker banking families, giving rise to Barclays Bank through cousinhood. Okay, so we'll keep on with Pennsylvania Quakers and slavery. At one point, Penn proposed that slaves in Pennsylvania be freed up to a certain period, and he wanted to create a township of Freetown. But the Quaker assembly, Quaker dominated assembly, refused to. Refused to take us forward. Okay, this is when he's still in his idealistic stage, at the beginning of the setting up of the colony.
That has something to do with the capital Sierra Leone, was called Freetown.
Yeah, it? Yeah. There's a lot of stuff, wasn't there? And yeah, absolutely. And Liberia, yeah, in Africa. Yeah, there's always kind of solutions to the problem that they created in the first place. How can we segregate? Get them out of the way. In the 1950s, wars disrupted immigration and cut down the number of indentured servants coming to the American states. the colonies. You can see between 49 and 54, there's 115 ships carrying 35,000 German immigrants. 55 to 56 is just three ships. For the 6 years, 57 to 63, there's only one ship bringing indentured labour. So they've got to find an alternative source to labour, to indentured labour. In the French and the Indian War, that's called the Indian War, a lot of indentured servants were commandeered into the military. So they were taken away as a labour pool. So Quakers began to buy slaves. Big time. Okay. Pennsylvania and the East Coast merchants started importing slaves directly from Africa. Before that, they'd acquired slaves in what was called small watts from the Caribbean islands. Okay. So you've got the Caribbean islands dependent on products like sugar. Yeah. There's such money in sugar, you know, the white gold, you know, sugar plantations, that they don't want to spend any acres at all planting food. So the food comes from your colony. Goes to the plantation, goes to the West Indian islands, yeah, and they come back with slaves. Okay. But at this point, in the mid-1750s, they started importing slaves directly from Africa, so they're not going through the Caribbean. Okay. Before 1741, 70% of slaves in northern colonies came from the West Indies. After 1741, 70% of the slaves come direct from Africa, so dealing directly with the African triangular slave trade. Okay, give you an idea. 1721 is about, roughly, I think there's a little thing comes up here. Okay, approximate totals. It's just under 5,000 in 1721. 15,000 slaves in Pennsylvania by 54, and then going up, you know, over 25,000 by 1766, because of all those factors I mentioned before. In Philadelphia, slaves are at work in Philadelphia at least in 1684, yeah, and within 5 years, there's white Quaker fears. You read yourself. But the tumultuous gatherings of Negroes in the town. Yeah, this isn't what they bargained for. They've got this nice big plan of this shiny, nice, clean, white Quaker town. Yeah, and there's all these people around. Hang on a minute. We didn't bargain for this. We didn't bargain for all this number of Africans in town. Yeah, I'll say most of them came in small lots. Prominent Philadelphia families brought slaves in this way. The Carpenters, Dickinsons, Norrises, and as I mentioned before, the Claybrooks.
Norristown.
Yeah.
There's Norristown.
Yeah. The Dickinsons with Maryland tobacco. Yeah. Involved in the administration, pretty much involved in some way in the administration of the state as well. So, in agriculture, yeah. You said we're economically dependent on trade with the slave economies of the West Indies. By supplying food to the West Indies, they were supporting economically and through trade the slave situation in the Caribbean, and were bringing back slaves to work in their own affairs. West Indian plantation owners, I think I mentioned all this before. So that trade, the trade of supplying foodstuffs to the Caribbean, actually sustained the slavery system. So in this region, you've got seasonal demands for labor because it was a temporary kind of situation you got here. Yeah. And you've got seasonal demands, and the farms didn't require large numbers of people to work the land. It wasn't like the southern plantations. farmers' preferred indentured servants. Just in Leicester County, 2,000 of bound servants held by the wealthiest farmers were in indentured, which means one third were the slaves, either African or Native American. And slaves are frequently seen as status symbols. So working in the fields when it was necessary, but working in the houses for the master and the mistress and their children. And in industry, we talked around, got a little frisson around the room about the iron industry. Okay, slaves were involved in industry as well, involved in the ports, involved in every aspect of industry, not just agriculture or domestic, but involved in industry, and especially in iron manufacturing. They were the largest industrial users of slaves, and they actually petitioned for a reduction on the tax on imported slaves. Because they keep their furnaces going and they're short of labour. A lot of those iron merchants had associated with this. In the cities, they weren't only using the in producing provisions on the land, but involved in the cities. 1700, 1 in 10 Philadelphians owned slaves. 1760s, slaves constituted 2/3 of the servant population in Philadelphia. Two-thirds of the servants were in black slaves. So slave ownership was practically universal by Quakerism in the cities. Only lack of slaves prevented many of them from increasing the number of slaves in their households. They would like to have had more slaves in their households, but they didn't have enough room in the house. Okay. When black slaves became pregnant, perhaps from the master, they were kicked out because there wasn't room for babies in the house. But while this is an abomination, it also gave certain freedom to those women who escaped the direct rule of their master. Moved to slaves and children living out, some measure of independence and freedom in the same. So if they did have children, then they moved out and were less under day to day, minute by minute, come here, do this, do that. Control of the masters. Indentured servitude, it was very difficult at times to define the difference between indentured servitude and being a slave. I mean, there was a difference, but if you were living it was hard to see the bloody difference. Servants themselves may have been kidnapped. There's numerous cases in Scotland, for example, where young people were kidnapped. You know, like the press gang used to go around, knock people on the head and put them on ships. They did the same thing, knock people on the head, trip them on ships, and when they wake up, they're in Pennsylvania. And you signed up indentured labour. Ooh, I've got to plug this in. Roger. Okay. Yep. Okay, normal terms, I mean, the range up to 17 years for indenture. Their children had very long indentures. Until they were 21, pretty much. It was a commodity that could be sold or traded. So you might not have finished your indenture, but you could be sold to somebody else. Transferred. Quaker meetings be called Quaker cruelty to indentured servants, whipping, beatings, being locked up for laziness, because laziness is, I'd say, not only a crime in Quaker eyes, but a sin. It's an anti-Protestant effort. The battery's running out, sorry. The battery's running out, sorry. You got a black bag, alright? It's okay. Okay, so ethnic and religious purity in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania. Okay, 1704. Because of his family connections, he recruited a lot of German immigrants quite early on. William Penn, 1711, several thousand Germans left New York for Pennsylvania. Because of the treatment they got in New York, they came to Pennsylvania to escape persecution. Thousands of Palatines, the Germans in the Rhine, including relatives of William Penn, came in their thousands to Pennsylvania.
Were they being persecuted?
Yeah. Lutheranism, Pietism. Oh. Yeah, as well. Pietist group. Big, and they were Penn's family through his mother's side of the family, Admiral Penn's mom. Logan, Mr. Logan again, yeah, said he gives the country some uneasiness, now they may usurp the country to themselves. Yeah. At one point, when the population of Pennsylvania was something like just over 3 million people, about a third of a million people were German. It was actually William Penn's mother's relatives who established Germantown, Pennsylvania, the Pietists. He went over there and invited them over. Yeah. Quaker authorities complained Germans seized upon the best vacant land. Yeah. A lot of anti-German feeling. Because that's not what they wanted. What they wanted was a Quaker paradise. Yeah, they placed a pound on the head of each newly arrived servant to try and deter immigration. And when the Scots-Irish arrived, Logan's pulling his hair out.
Yeah, but he's relatives in a way.
Yeah, tough, isn't it? Yeah, they're not Quakers. Yeah, they're Presbyterians and God knows what. Yeah. He said it looked as if Ireland was going to send all her inhabitants to this province and feared that they would make themselves masters of it. Yeah. Yeah, and then a further 58,000 Germans, 16,500 Scots-Irish sailed up the Delaware in the 20 years. Yeah. Because of that kind of attitude, yeah, that's why the German population fought for the revolution and did not support the Quakers. Yeah, because of the discrimination that they endured, and the ridicule on Benjamin Franklin and others. Quakers' opposition to others often based on racist grounds. I propose. Yeah. Yeah. They wanted white Quakers filled with the Protestant word. Quakers in Pennsylvania wrote the Quakers in Barbados the president to stop supplying slaves to Philadelphia as the city was being overstretched. Okay. This is quite often, in Britain, this is quite often an argument. About immigration. Oh, we've been overstretched. It's got to be. Yeah. Foreigners, now it's Polish. We've been overstretched. Overstretched over here. Okay, now that's going way back. Similar kind of action. Okay. So the sympathy towards slaves and slave welfare declined in Quaker minds. Because they felt it was getting out of hand. Yeah, it's okay when you've got a nice minority, you're obedient, but once, hang on a minute, it's getting out of hand, we don't like this anymore. Yeah. And particularly because slaves who were free often absconded, left their master, and became a nuisance in Quaker eyes, and came up against the laws which were incredibly strict in this province. Incredibly. If you broke the laws, you suffered all kinds of punishment. William Penn himself complained about the cost of the keep of one of his female slaves. Sad. Quakers called for restrictions on the number of slaves introduced into Pennsylvania and introduced a 20-fold increase of the tax to £2 a head to reduce the number of, reduce the black population in the state. This was, I do know. It'll be in the booklet. When you buy the booklet, you'll find out. Okay. Part of this income was promised to Penn. So when he went to England, he lobbied for this with the Board of Trade. Okay, but it was unsuccessful. And the Board of Trade said, get lost. We made a lot of money out of slave trade. No way are we going to start reducing it. Yeah.
Because it's made to make money.
Yeah. It's Protestant. Yeah. He's carrying out God's will. It made money, it made sense. It was God's will. It's predetermined, isn't it?
Calvinist, isn't it?
Yeah, it is Calvinist. Yeah. The governors also wanted to prevent the movement of Indians into Pennsylvania, except for those born or naturalized here.
How could they tell?
They have papers, didn't you? Yeah. It's the old pass system, isn't it? There's a couple of examples of Quakers saying they did not want to be buried alongside blacks. Middletown, Dauphin County. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe Williamstown. Okay. So Samuel Hart speaking in 1845 and said 60 years ago, so around 1780. He remembers he could stand on the corner of his father's farm, 20 miles from Philly, on the old York Road. Yeah. Commanding extensive view of the county, beautiful situation, etc. And from that spot I could count 16 farmhouses, and in every house, more or less, to other slope. 1780. Just down the road. You got time? Oh, it's okay. No, it's alright. That's okay.
We have a paper.
Yeah. So Benjamin Franklin, yeah, we just passed, we had the pleasure of seeing his offices down the road, his newspaper offices.
Well, he was indentured himself to his brother and ran away.
Yeah.
And I think he was
going on a slave. He was a jackal. He owned slaves, yeah. Benjamin Franklin owned slaves. And he didn't
own many, though, did he?
I wonder how many slaves you have to own.
No, I thought it was only like his household staff, like his, a couple of them.
Well, he didn't have an estate. Really,
I know.
So why would he?
He had what he needed.
I withdraw the comment.
Yeah, it's okay. it's a fair point.
It's a number. It's just the number.
Yeah,
that's all I'm saying. I'm saying nothing else.
No, you're right. You're right. Yeah. He owned a small number of. A small number of slaves.
Because if you're saying Penn like had slaves on Pennsbury, if he was that decorative or was that a working farm?
No, they worked on the.
So he must have had a fair.
It was better that they were blacks because then one has them for life. He did away with indentured labour and preferred slave labour.
So it's a big estate. I'm not thinking about Franklin. If it's a big estate,
3,000 acres.
Must have had a fair number of slaves there.
Yeah. They don't know how many it was.
Did he later turn against slavery, or did he keep those?
No. Only in his first will did he...
You mean Penn? Ben Franklin.
Oh, Franklin. Yeah, he did. Okay. So we touch on Benjamin Franklin then. Very quickly. Okay, his Pennsylvania Gazette, right, his newspaper, had numerous paid adverts for the sale of slaves and notices of runaway slaves. Right. And quite often these adverts said at the end, inquire of the owner of the slave or the printer hereof. And if people went in and reported the escaped slave to Benjamin Franklin, then Benjamin Franklin got a cut of the whole price. He got his cut, as well as paid for the ad. So often the ad would end up, inquire of the prince with it. He would handle the sale, if it was a sale, the slave. He would handle that slave transaction on behalf of the prospective owner and take a commission. Okay. And if it was a runaway slave, he would get a commission for putting them all back there. Another of his advertisements showed how the splitting of families just seemed to, I've written here, through this lens of profit and loss. And one ad that he ran in his newspaper was, a female slave would be sold with a two-year-old son, but another boy, aged about 6 years, who is the son of the above said woman, would be sold with his mother, or by himself, as the purchaser desires.
How old was he?
Well, he actually had a 2-year-old son and another boy at 8 and 6. But not all colonial newspapers carried such adverts. In the booklet, which you're all going to buy, yeah? In the Republic, yeah? You're all going to buy, yeah? We're being presented on the counter of Jesus. There is reference, you know, to Quaker opposition to slavery, etc., and some valiant men and women who fought against this government. Not all colonial newspapers, for example, carried such ads. Christopher Sawyer's German language newspaper refused to carry them. Refused. Franklin became an abolitionist late in life. He joined the Quakers and other liberals in petitioning Congress to abolish slavery. But that petition faced strong opposition and failed. 880, he became president of the Pennsylvania Society for the Abolition of Slavery, an organization that still exists today.
Did he support slavery and then oppose slavery because it was fashionable? Like, I was just wondering that about Ben Franklin, because he opposed Masons as un-Christians, then he later joined the Masons. Like, it was about the slavery thing, sort of like a similar.
Similar kind of thing happened in Bristol. Yeah, a lot of the merchants, when there was no money in it, there was no need for it. There was no need to support slavery if there was no money in it. It was against your own interests. The thing about slavery is that you're not earning money, you're not going to buy any commodities. Yeah. Abolition of the Quakers. I've written here, it's probably not a coincidence that the discussion began in the Pennsylvania Assembly in 1778 to abolish slavery only happened after Delaware had seceded from Pennsylvania, because 3/4 of the black slaves in Pennsylvania at that time worked in Delaware. Yeah. So it was only when the majority of slaves were in a separate state that the Pennsylvania Assembly started to debate the abolition of slavery. So moral arguments against slavery were buttressed by the practical consideration that slaves no longer played an important role in the economy. And also, Quakers were not involved politically. They'd been usurped by that time. They weren't in control of the assembly after the revolution. They were sidelined. The Presbyterians who came through around the events then, pretty much. Thank you very much. I guess it was being with some trepidation now.